talking about West African empires, and when I think about quite a few West African empires, of course, we think about Ghana, and I'm not talking about the current state or country of Ghana as it stands, but of course Mali as well, the Songhai Empire, Benin. There's a bunch we can go through. What do we know? Does anybody know about Jeanne Jeannot?
With regard to ancient Ghana, that was ancient Ouagadougou.
Right.
That misnomer is, that's something, I'll get into the Jeanne thing in a minute, but that whole misnomer as to why it's called, that region is called Ghana today, as opposed to, you know, the region where it actually was. I mean, that's just, it's just a classic example of just how misappropriated West African history is, like, you know, but yeah.
Yes, absolutely it is. I mean, you see the same thing when we think about it was a lot of these so-called countries. I mean, I want to say it was appropriated, but it was definitely adopted into these other countries. Same thing with the entire Africa being known as Ethiopia. Now we have a country known as Ethiopia as well. It kind of gets adopted into these names for these particular independent countries now. And then when we're talking about Jeanne Jeannot, again, what Trey was talking about, part around that Ghana Empire, I believe as well, one of the oldest found ruined settlements as far as what they have dated it to, around 300 years before the Common Era. There was iron tools and jewelry that would highly suggest a civilization over in Jeanne Jeannot. If you did want to look that up, it is starts with almost like Django, so D-J-E-N-E. And then Jeanno. It is quite a few ruins that we will be able to find out more about it once more archaeological evidence becomes more prevalent. But yeah, these are part of those particular founding civilizations that we know of as well.
I think when we talk about West African history, I think we should kind of make distinctions between which West Africa we're talking about. Because technically, Mali and, you know, Nigeria, they're all included as quote unquote West Africa. But so you have the Saharan, the Western Saharan region, to the Southern Sahelian belt, which is, you know, from Niger to Mali and all that, you know, it's the rim of the Sahara, which, of course, you know, that region has been heavily populated since early to mid Holocene. You know, a lot of Nilotic peoples, you know, dominated that region. So you have the Saharan region and you also have the Forest Belt region. The Forest Belt region, is the region that begins around that Ghana, Benin, Togo, Nigerian region. And I think that we should make distinctions between which regions of West Africa we're talking about. Because we know, for example, the Saharan region, there is much archaeological activity in that region for thousands upon thousands upon thousands of years. We know that, you know, from Dar Tichit and whatnot, which I'll get into that in a minute. But as far as the Forest Belt is concerned, there are ancient settlements, but they're more sparse in dating, and they don't really show in many cases a continuous inhabitation for the most part. Now, you know, they're still looking at stuff. They're still finding stuff. But, I think that's an important distinction to make when we're talking about, quote unquote, ancient West African history, you know.
Hey, this is Lucifer. I'm going to re-upload that custom map I made of Central Africa versus West Africa.
Absolutely. You can go ahead and do that, Lou. We can do that. And then when we're talking about the Ghana Empire, they dated to about 600 A.D., there is the Tonka, who was the king of Ghana, I believe the first king, kept sons as hostages in royal court to maintain their allegiance. Aoundé is about also in North Mauritania. They had camel caravan centers. They had many ruins that were found. It was likely a big port for trade, and especially when it came to gold and trading with the likes of like other North Africans and Arabs. But we know that Africa was the hub for gold, and we know this even by other ruling classes later on, like Mansa Musa, who would go on to, pretty much be very much flaunting of his gold. He made a little bit of mockery, I would say, but Arab writers of that time would expound upon the gold that was being made in Africa, almost mythological in a sense, and how they explained it. And then, so we're going to move on to Al-Bukhari. Again, 1057. All of them, it was go on to say that all of them would shave their beards, and the women would shave their heads. The king adorns himself like a woman, wearing necklaces around their necks and bracelets on their forearms. He put on a high cap, decorated with gold and wrapped in a turban of fine cotton. He sits in audience or to hear grievances against officials in a domed pavilion around which stand 10 horses, covered with gold embroidered materials. So he was basically saying how these the emperors of Ghana were of like a chief state. They would listen to the prevailing issues within the community and be sort of a figure or a mediator there as part of that state, and in a pavilion of all things as well. And they obviously held their horses to highest standard as they embroidered them also.
Yeah, for if I could give context to this conversation, so you want to think of it as, I mean, Ghana's not in Ghana. That's the first step that is kind of weird, right? It's in parts of Mauritania and Mali, southeast Mauritania and western Mali specifically. And then Ghana is the first one. And so Ghana, very early on, you see like the 300 AD, the camel is introduced into the western Sahel, and that sort of transformed trade in the region. A lot of people, they have a talking point about like, well, when did Africans invent the wheel and whatnot? So the terrain, first of all, a lot of places in Africa are not very conducive to using wheels, right? But also, certain regions of Africa didn't have domesticates such as horses, right? Horses were first introduced into Africa by the Hyksos in ancient Egypt, right? The camel was first domesticated. The camel was first domesticated, likely in the Horn of Africa. We know that cattle were domesticated someplace in North Africa, probably by Nilo-Saharan speakers. But the introduction to the camel to the Sahel was transformative, in allowing people in the Sahel to trade in the Trans-Saharan slave trade. They were trading salt and gold, and sometimes people in this large trade. But the Ghana Empire is the oldest, and then next comes the Mali Empire, and then the Songhai Empire. For the Ghana Empire, you have the Soninke people. The Soninke people are people who are similar to Mandinka people. They speak a Mande language. Today, you find them in Senegal, Guinea, the Gambia, Mauritania, Foudadjalan, Mali. Okay, so the Soninke people are the people who founded the Ghana Empire, which was not in Ghana, but rather in Mali and Mauritania. And then you have the Mali Empire. Now, the Mali Empire, some people date it back to, I think Maroc was saying 700, some people argue earlier. A lot of the writings we have about the Mali Empire are from Islamic scholars who aren't necessarily of these people. So that has to be taken into account. But the ruling dynasty of the Mali Empire, they were called the Kita, until I believe it was Son Diatta Kita. He passed away, and then they went by the name Musa. And that's how you get people like Mansa Musa later on. The ruling dynasty were of the Mali Empire were a Mandinka people called the Bambara. If you check Louisiana's roles of enslaved people, you will find many, 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 many people who are Bambara. So that's of interest if you're an African-American. But after some decline, you saw that the Songhai Empire came to replace and supplant the Mali Empire in places like Timbuktu. And as soon as the Songhai rose and took places like Timbuktu, you saw other North Africans sort of fight against this sort of expansionism. And so it was always empire after empire in this region of Africa. And these people, I mean, tell me that a Bambara person isn't black, right? Tell me that a Mandinka person isn't black. Tell me that the Soninke weren't black. These people had great African empires in the Sahel and parts of North Africa. It's just a part of West African history.
Let me speak on that real quick, because something interesting that is not very well noted is that when the Arabs came into Africa during the Islamic conquest, not only did they attempt to take Nubia, but they also went over into West Africa and tried to take Ghana. And my question would be to anybody who might know a little more about this is, how smooth was the transition from, you know, a traditional African, you know, ran civilization into a Muslim dominated region and population? You know, because we know the man of the day are almost exclusively Muslims. So does anybody know about that transition, or did it occur during that time period?
Yes, he actually proved my point with the introduction of the camels, 300 AD. 600 AD was the Mamluk slave revolt in Black Arabia. So that's when the white concubines and their princely descendants, because the Black Arabs were not practicing racism for some reason, those people overthrew the Black Arabs, kicked them out into Northern Africa, and took over that region and started invading Eastern Africa and then Northern Africa over the next following century using Islam as a cover. So 600 AD to 700 AD, that's when the Blackamoors reform and reorganize in Western Africa, because Visigothic Roman North Africa refused to help them because that was white people. So yeah, they went down to Morocco, set up a defensive base. Then they went further south into Western Africa, Mauritania, Mali, Ghana, and recruited their elite soldiers and took them 711 AD into Spain, France, Germany, and eventually England. That's how you get the Black Amaris in Europe. So it was a racial ambush in Arabia that led to a racial counterattack in Southern Europe.
So there were very early, in terms of Muslims, whether these empires were just, you want to look at them as just Muslim empires, I wouldn't simplify
that. Negative. I cannot say that, because the Blackamoors arrived Ethiopians.
Lucifer, sir. Anyways, I was saying, you can't simplify that as such, right? There is recordings, very early recordings of like contact and trade between people, and they would convert to Islam. But even if you talk about the Muslim leaders here, right, which not all of them are Muslim, by the way, they did not practice an orthodox form of Islam. They were more syncretic, right, in that they kept their native sort of African animistic, if I dare say, traditions, but also, you know, identified as Muslim, were very important Muslim scholars in exchanges of knowledge at places such as Timbuktu. One of the earliest recordings of a conversion of one of these leaders to Islam comes from Ibn Khaldun in 1397. And so these empires predate, I suppose, the conversion of a lot of leaders to Islam. But yeah, they were absolutely influenced by the Arab conquest of North Africa and the subsequent spread of Islam. It's just that these people were advanced and doing great things and building great civilizations before they had converted to Islam. So those histories are tied and interconnected, but you cannot reduce these. It's like, oh yeah, it's, when Islam came, these people started.
That is not my argument at all. I'm saying that
I'm not arguing with you. I'm just talking about the subject.
Yes, he wanted to know the background of what happened to the Western African countries. The Islamists showed up, and they were racist from the get-go because they were white supremacists. So they actually degraded the Western African stability is what I'm coming to realize as I learn more about Western African kingdoms. So everything started to destabilize after the Arabs showed up 600 AD, along with your camels.
Yeah, so you're conflating Islamist with Arab. And when I'm talking about Muslims, I'm talking about just Muslims, right? And the spread of Islam. I'm not assigning a race to people and a religion, right?
I am, because their race was called the Mamluks.
I understand that's what you're doing. I'm saying we shouldn't do that because there were most of the Muslims here were black, right?
Yes.
And so if you mean Arab, just say Arab instead of saying Muslim. That's all I'm asking you.
Okay, well, the Arabs are black, and the Muslim is from a Somali-Ethiopian branch of their faith. So everything's black in the Arab.
Cool. So when it comes to places like Timbuktu, it became a part of the Mali Empire in the 14th century, right? A century later, Tuareg people, right, if you're familiar with them, they're a Berber tribe. They took control of Timbuktu, right, very briefly. Before the Songhai absorbed Timbuktu in 1468. So that kind of transition, like that shuffling of power and position of Timbuktu was important. It was like not only a center for Islamic scholars, right? But it was a center for trade, right? Many of the trade routes stopped in Timbuktu. It was a place of great
learning. But also what about the Greek scholars?
Hold up. It was also a place of great wealth, okay? And so after the shuffling between these different Africans, these different Sahelians, I should say, a Moroccan army came in, snatched it from the Songhai in 1591, and then installed the Arma people as rulers. And so ever since then, Timbuktu was in decline.
Okay, so I'm still lost on your relevancy here. He wanted to know about what happened to the Western African cultures, and I told him the decline began.
I'm just speaking about
the decline of Western African culture began 600 AD. That's my point. So as the Muslims or Anglo-Arabs called Mamluks trickled into Northern and Eastern Africa, so travels their degeneracy. Because when they established Islam in Arabia, it was by a warlord called Prophet Muhammad. And he was described as biracial in his Arabic texts. So he is not a white man and he is not a black native Arab. He is mix of both. They have a special word in Arabic.
But personally, I just think that when it comes to the spread of Islam,
it doesn't matter what their opinion is. That's the facts that their ancestors wrote down, bro.
It has nothing to do with the decline or the rise of these West African empires. These people were very important to the foundations of like Islam and Islamic scholarship. But I wouldn't say that it was Muslims who tore these kingdoms
I can't take your opinion. I can't take your opinion because I wrote down notes as you were doing your long spiel, and you got so many factors wrong that we just covered last week.
I just have one more sentence. And I wouldn't say that these empires started declining in 600 when most of them did not exist in 600 AD. That doesn't make any sense.
You said Timbuktu didn't exist until...
Well, let's be clear here, because according to UNESCO, the Ghana Empire did start at least around 600 AD, and that's just the starting point. So they had to have...
Could they be declining in 600 AD if that's just when they're just starting?
Because that's when racial integration with the Mamluk white groups coming into Africa began. That's how the concept works, bro.
No, I didn't ask you, Lucifer. I was speaking to Maroc. So that's why it doesn't make sense, Maroc, because if they started around that time, how could that be the decline? When the Songhai Empire is the 15th and 16th century, it's like 1,000 years later. How could the start of decline be 600 years before something exists?
Same way Timbuktu is referenced by the ancient Greeks.
I think we need to start with a historical foundation, right? And then we can spur off into the conspiracy theory.
I got to correct some of your chronology here. Bodhi, I got to correct some of your chronology here. Okay, your camels 300 AD, I did not know about that, but that matches up exactly with what I thought. Arabic influence in Africa began around 600 AD, as I have stated repeatedly. Mamluk slave revolt in Arabia equals white people now run Black Arabia. They're racist. They start invading Africa, and under the guise of open trade policy, they put out blankets for the local Black Negroid people and then ambush them, kidnap them, and sell them into slavery in a now white-run Arabia, 600 AD. They do it for a century until the Black Moors get their shit together and retaliate against white people in Europe. It's just that simple. That's literally what happened. That's what they did. That's how they lived. It's like, right. It's a race war.
Let me go into Mauritania as well. We were talking about there were vast mosques and buildings dating back to about 13th century AD as well. When I'm talking about the Ghana Empire, again, this is about 600 AD till about 1076. This is according to UNESCO. So we see even in written form, they have been vastly influenced by the Muslims at this point. There is vast amounts of documents and scholar for sciences, mathematics, astronomy, law, all written in many different forms of Arabic written language as well. Salt was a great commodity. The rock salt was a great commodity, again, for the Ghana Empire. A lot of these Arabic or Muslim scholars would write down the histories of what they would witness as well. At the door of the pavilion are dogs of excellent pedigree who will hardly ever leave their place where the king is guarding him. Rulers of Ghana started to lose control of their empire, coupled with environmental factors like overgrazing and other groups like the Mande people, which led to about a new leadership. I believe Bodhi already mentioned him, Sojourner Nakita as well, who eventually built what is known as the Mali Empire. And again, the Mali Empire would then be the new face after the demise of the Ghana Empire. The Mali Empire would be assumed again by Kida, who was known as a Mansa. And he went on to tax all the goods going in and out of Mali. So they seen a lot of trade as well during this period, what brought them to great success. Again, a lot to do with that trade in salts and golds and a lot of their crafts and their sciences as well. Does anybody want to expound on that?
You're talking about the transition between Ghana and Mali?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. I was just going to say is that, you know, Ghana.
Do we agree with that downfall?
What'd you say?
Do we agree with that downfall?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. But when it came to Mali was actually one of the, maybe I'm going to have to look at the competitors, but it was probably one of the largest states ever in African history. Okay, Songhai is the biggest. So, let's look at the area that Songhai covers, though. It's several countries, right? Yeah. So I think Songhai also covers parts of
Burkina Faso,
Nigeria, if I'm not correct. Yeah. Let's see.
It's somewhere near Sierra Leone and Mali. Then,
the political organizations would fall apart, right? So, like but there was always going to be someone. Some ruling dynasty who would take over because these people were interconnected. A lot of these people are Mandinka-like people, are Sahelian people to begin with the exception of the Songhai. The Songhai proper, they speak a Nilo-Saharan language, I believe. And so they are the result of people who've migrated over from somewhere in the Nile Valley in East Africa. Because they still speak a Nile, the Songhai proper.
Yeah.
Because they still speak a Nilo Saharan language to this day.
Yeah, I think they came from Sudan. Like, that's my thesis right there. Like, I think they migrated like at some point in time, and because folks from Sudan, they're nomads due to climate, so they shift, from place to place if the climate gets like way too bad. So I definitely do agree with your point there.
Absolutely. So yeah, we did see a demise from the Ghana Empire, which led to the uprising in the Mali Empire. So we do know Mali for being best known for Timbuktu. Timbuktu was another hub for traders and scholars alike. Again, with that same astronomy and sciences and mathematics that was going on as well. At the height of its power, Mali had at least 400 cities and one of the biggest economies in salt and gold once again. Some people might not know that in 2012, there were several buildings in Timbuktu, including 14 of the 16 mausoleums, in which formed part of the World Heritage Site for UNESCO. It had gotten destroyed as part of an armed conflict and civil unrest. Attacks are targeted from Al-Farouk, which had been completely destroyed, and estimated about 4,203 manuscripts from the Institute of Higher Islamic Studies and Research. It concluded that Ahmed Baba were burnt or stolen by armed groups. Ahmed, in 2016, the International Court had convicted him for directing these attacks that destroyed many of these documents. Does anybody aware of that particular moment in 2012? I remember hearing that and being like, damn.
You talking about when the terrorists went around killing, I mean, yeah, it was kind of heartbreaking to hear that shit, but I heard that a lot of them people put that shit up under their, like they buried that shit in their backyards and in the dirt in their homes and shit. So, you know, they would save hundreds of thousands of manuscripts that way.
Yeah, like I said, a lot of them were completely destroyed, if not just taken as hostage from those extremists as well. Because of that, they have made it harder for people to come in and out of Timbuktu because of that hostile environment and what has been created within Timbuktu or around Timbuktu since 2012. So if you are to get access to Timbuktu at this point, you are likely to be accompanied by armed guards if you could even get in the first place.
It was crazy. Yep. Like I remember, like actually, like watching them actually like do that shit, and like it was almost like somebody paid them to like do that shit. But yeah, I don't know. Like I remember, like just they had like different scenes of like the Arab looking motherfuckers destroying the artifacts and shit, and like it was almost like they were like taking pleasure in doing the shit. Like it wasn't just like a missile hit it or nothing. No, like they were going unscrewing shit. Like, and it's like it just reeked of just white people. Just yeah, I'm just being real. It just reeked of white people telling them to do shit that they would do. Like I mean, just if I can find that video, I'll post it. But I mean, it was just the dude really looked insane, just like really like unscrewing shit, just like destroying it, just to destroy it. Like no other purpose other than just destroying it. Like it was just like I just couldn't help but think that it was some Western contrived shit. News.
Everyone in here is aware that the terrorist group known as ISIL or ISIS is systematically going through Oman and Yemen and other Black and Arab countries and destroying the ancient Ethiopian carvings throughout those countries. Are you guys aware of that? Nope. It actually began under Obama's watch. But apparently no one's raised the alarm about it.
You know, and again, that's the shit I'm talking about. Like, it's... I mean, I didn't even know they were doing this shit over there in the Arabian Peninsula, but it's just like... I don't even want to say what I want to say on here, but it's just...
No. We got to get to a point where we have to say this, because we're still watching a race war play out in slow motion. Like, no one's talking about how Obama, a biracial president, allowed the now whitewashed, albinized Saudi Arabians to invade Oman and Yemen and bomb the hell out of those millions of people that are Black Arabs. They're the indigenous DNA of that region. And they keep calling them Southern Arabs this, Southern Arab that. They are the indigenous people from 7000 BC, the first successful migration group from Somali Ethiopia to colonize Arabia itself. That's what the genome mapping has now proven. They put it up on YouTube. Everyone has access to it. No one's talking about the fact white Arabs are killing the natives who are Black Africans. What is going on here? Like, why are we not saying this stuff? Like, we're all getting snuffed off the board one by one.
They've been doing that for centuries. Well, not centuries, but, you know, at least for they're
doing it with drones now. So we got to up our game. This is a new paradigm. These drones allow white people to have infinite war as long as they can steal resources from some gullible chumps called Africans who are just giving away all their metals and resources.
Timbuktu. Okay, all right. So when it comes to any of these dynasties, right, obviously white historians have done the same thing they've done with every other civilization, right? And where they're like, oh, was it Moroccans? Was it Northern African Berbers? Maybe it was Arabs. Who knows who really founded these things, right? But that's all been laid to rest at this point. One point of contention historically is about who founded Timbuktu, okay? Some people propose a Songhai origin. And so a part of the connection is that they try to go by, like, what does the word Timbuktu mean? Like, what is the meaning of Timbuktu, okay? And so Leo Africanus, I'm sure we're familiar with that historian, right? He believes that it's Songhai, okay? And so it would actually be Timbuktu, Tin meaning wall, right? And then Butu, he doesn't explain the meaning of it. And so he tried to break it down into Songhai, failed, because we don't even know what Butu means. There's a Malian historian by the name of Sikina Sissoko, right? And they proposed that it was Torex, okay, who founded Mali. And so the Berber name would be Tim, meaning in place of, and Bokto, meaning a small dune, right? And so Timbuktu would mean a place covered by small dunes, if it was indeed the Tuareg. Then there's Abd al-Sadi. His explanation is that it was also the Tuareg, right? But he gives a different sort of meaning of the word Timbuktu. It means the blessed spot where she encamped, which is it's connecting Timbuktu to a slave woman. I love that slave trope. They always use it for some reason. There's a French Orientalist who believes it comes from the Zenaga people. So those are Berbers of the Sanhaja clan, or Moors rather, right? And it means distant or hidden in a feminine way. So yeah, I mean, there's no consensus about this. Somehow they can dig up 3,000, 5,000 years into ancient Egypt, but they cannot find any archaeological remains in the city of Timbuktu for some reason.
We all know that.
Hold on. Here's some more historical context from the European side of the pond. Timbuktu, the college system in ancient Kemet, the one in Timbuktu, and the one in Sumeria or Mesopotamian regions, those were listed as the places where Greek and Roman scholars had to go be educated. So yeah, to say that Timbuktu is a modern construct, I can't believe that, because the ancient Greeks are saying, yeah, we traveled into Africa to go to college. And that's like 1000 BC. So Timbuktu had to exist as a school system.
Let me ask a question just about, because, you know, some people have, you know, written in some publications that at some point within the last 2000 years, for example, the Niger River, in the Western Sahara, they said that there was like 10 stretches of civilizations, almost like the Nile Valley. They said it was just like continuous habitations, buildings, homes, everything. Just, you know, anybody else, you know, heard that historical sentiment or?
Yes. And Lou actually, again, Lou pointed out last time, we're going to be talking about waterway systems or civilizations as well as part of an upcoming topic as well. But Lou, go ahead and expound upon it.
Yes, the Green Sahara periods is what academics are calling it, but they say it's just like how the tides come in and go out. There's gigantic stretches of like 10,000 plus years of fertility, rain, and interconnected waterways within Africa, like literally across the whole of the central part of Africa. And you can just sail on these waterways from one end of Africa to the other. So all our migration maps are kind of janky because they don't accommodate for this. They keep saying the Sahara is a physical land barrier, but if we go back about 5,000 years, the Sahara might not even exist at all. It's just a big flat green meadow where horses are eating grass and black Libyans are riding them as dual horse chariots. That's what's on their rock art from 7,000 BC. So everything Bodhi was saying about the chronology was already fucked by modern satellite scans of that whole region. When Herodotus talked about the the Under-Sahara Sea that ran underneath the Great Pyramids of Egypt, they thought he was a crazy madman making up shit and called him a great deceiver and liar. The satellites scanned the underground subsoil layer and found what? A giant lake of underground water running underneath the pyramids. And it used to be bigger because there was more water on the surface 5,000 years plus ago. So all our concepts are garbage right now. And people are still making this argument, oh, sub-Saharan Negroids are a different ethnic group and phenotype. It's like, no, sub-Saharan Negroids are literally all of the African Negroid types at those times because nothing is stopping their rapid fertility and expansion across into Asia and Europe. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. They can just stroll into a garden of oases going into the horizon forever. Like, that's wild. And then 10,000 years later, it's gone. But guess what? All their cultures, sciences, and traditions are just sprinkled all over Africa in the Yoruba and the Kemet and the Somalis and all their shared Bantu language groups. Yeah, they used to be one people. It's the Tower of Babel. Like, it's obvious.
Yeah, you know, the climate has changed, you know, from the past, like, 4,000 to 5,000 years, you know. Like, before that, the Sahara, yeah, it was definitely all green. Since, like, you know, there's a lot of archaeology finding, you know, old, very old villages. They're finding, pottery. They're pretty much finding, like, almost a lot of, you know, people who were actually living there, like, thousands of years ago, like, before climate, you know, it destroyed, you know, well, not destroyed, like, nature took its place and, you know, just created, you know, like, a sea of sand. But eventually, you know, like if it's possible, you know, since we got technology, like, we can probably, you know, like, turn that whole entire place green again. But it's going to take some time to do that.
Well, hold on. That's another thing. The white people are calculating that it takes like thousands of years to do this climate shift in the Green Sahara. I no longer believe that because I stumbled across a recording in Queen T. I believe she's the grandfather of the Ramses line. Queen T, that lady with the afro that you've seen her bust. Yeah, she wrote in her journal that she literally watched the western half of the Nile just desertify within her lifetime. So it doesn't take thousands of years. It doesn't even take hundreds of years. It can happen in decades. Just bitch dries up. No more hunting over there. And she's writing that down in her journal as a royal noble. I'm like, oh my God, like, wait, how many times has it flip-flop like that? And how fast can it happen if that's the time span I got to work with? So the scientists are saying, no, it's slow. It's real gradual. And I'm looking at all these, the Libyans, when Bodhi said they had no horses, he doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about. The Libyans are doing rock art 7,000 BC, two horses pulling a wheel chariot across meadows in southern Libya. That's the Sahara Desert, my dude. It shouldn't exist. Guess what? They were riding them damn horses because the horses live there and they're eating well. So once it turned into a desert overnight. Yeah, once the Sahara. Who was that?
Bodhi said what year?
What year?
Yeah, 7,000 BC, the rock art. Radiocarbon dated. So yeah, and they also found
rock art showing Libyans using what?
Using horse-drawn chariots with wheels.
Yeah, that's a fantastic claim. Do you have it's not
a claim. I've already posted the image to other people who were denial and skeptical. So it's a real artifact. We already have it. Mm-hmm. Nobody in academia is talking about it because it upsets everybody's modeling of migrations from Central Africa.
Where did those horses come from?
Yeah, probably America, now that we have the Egyptian maps.
So that's how seriously I'm going to take the claim now. Let's just move on.
Hold on. No. I still have to counteract all your babble that you spouted earlier. I made a list, and I keep getting dropped every time I start. Okay, so camels 300 AD. Cool. Awesome. Mamluks arrived with their camels. Gotcha. Chariot, 7,000 BC, Libyans riding them on the horses. Gotcha. And these are Negroids with afros, by the way. So you can't say they're some mythical white race. They don't exist in North Africa, especially. Green Sahara, at least 45,000 BC, when Africans are going into the pincer movement into Europe and Turkey and Anatolia and Asia. Yeah, they're going through the Green Sahara to do that, because this is not one time it happens. It happens multiple times. So we might be able to just, if we predict when the Green Sahara shifts happen,
we might just round down every single major out of African expansion, including domesticated animals, included their linguistics. Everything is tied to the Green Sahara. When it's green, they move through it. When it's dry, they don't. That's about it. That's their whole culture in Africa. Okay. So
since I'm talking about it, let's talk about it. So you're saying these horses came from America to Libya 7,000 years ago?
I did not say that. I said it's possible that they came from America.
How Egypt, is it possible?
Because Africans populated the entire world by 100,000 BC. We know that as a genome fact.
How did they bring horses? Okay, so how did...
It's called trade. They traded the horses back to the old world.
Quickly. How did the horses get from the Americas to Africa?
On boats, Bodhi. They're called boats, ships, convoys, caravans.
Okay. Now then, how did the horses get to America?
They might have evolved over there. Zebra also expanded across the earth before humans did. You do realize that, right? African animals were found in Asia as well. You are aware of this, right?
So you're telling me that... So these are horses that they had domesticated, right? They're domesticated horses, right?
By 7,000 BC, Africans had domesticated horses. They're not riding zebras, Bodhi.
But they domesticated horses that came from America?
I don't know where they came from, but it's more likely they came from America if we can't find evidence of them within Asia. Do you have evidence
of domesticated horses in North America? Or South America, or Central America?
We have the 3,500 BC Egyptian map of the New World, including North and South America, with the alpacas on it, and the horses are in the Northern Americas. So yes, they were aware of American Mustangs, 3,500 BC in ancient Egypt, right, in the Nile area. Right, but you're talking
about 7,000 BC. So I'm wondering, there had to be horses before 7,000 BC in the Americas. Do you have any evidence for that?
Why would they not be horses in America if America has a wild Mustang population from the get-go?
We can assume a lot of things, Lucifer. I'm just asking if you had any evidence.
I do not have evidence outside of a time machine, bro. What are you talking about? Horses are endemic to America as well.
As long as we both acknowledge you don't have evidence for that claim, we can move forward.
Okay, well, let's move on since you want to cherry pick one talking point. Anyway, the cows.
Speaking of America, though, I was going to get into it a little bit more that when we're talking about the Mali Empire, we can't not talk about al-Bukhari as well. And Shihab Umari, a famous Arab geographer, he reported from his informant the following. He had about 200 ships equipped and filled with men and others in the same field with gold, water, and supplies in sufficient quantity to last for years. He told those who commanded them, return only when you have reached the extremity of the ocean or when you have exhausted all of your food or water. They went away and their absence was long before any of them could return. Finally, one sole ship did return. Al-Bukhari was the next successor. Reveals that the Mandinka monarch made great preparation for his journey and had confidence in its success. His captain, who reported the violent river in the mid-Atlantic, must have encountered a mid-ocean current, but as the report shows, he had little difficulty returning to the West African coast. Currents either of whose distance from the West African coast at the latitude would place the fleet at the doorstep of the Americas. Does anybody want to expand upon Bakari's expedition across the Atlantic Ocean? Bakari, he did sail across the ocean. That's due to oral tradition. And then we also had that in document from a Muslim, Shihab Umari, who also documented that he was sending over at least 200 ships at that point.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Hold on. Who has the link to the Algonquin Arabic script they found in the New World before Columbus?
Oh, that would be Oromo.
Yes, because that's probably the connection point between Western African and New World East Indian Negroids that they knew about when the pilgrims got there. So it's not confusing if you know these people are traveling internationally. They're picking up horses. So in fact, the ancient Egyptians, King Tut was buried with Australian boomerangs. So to say that they can't get horses from America, that's absurd. They're getting golden boomerangs from Australian tribes people specifically. So they're shopping internationally, even in the Bronze Age, bro. It's not a modern concept at all. Oh, and then we have to talk about the cocaine from Colombia and the New World. So yeah, the Egyptians were shopping internationally thousands of years before Europeans even know Marco Polo could be a thing. It's like, bro.
So yeah, his expedition was known orally and has also been well documented as well. According to UNESCO, Mansa Musa was accompanied by more than 60,000 people after al-Bukhari had went and left for his expedition to the Americas. That's when the notorious Mansa Musa came to prestige. And again, he brought about 60,000 people who traveled with him from Mali over to Mecca. Before he reached Mecca, he had also made a point to stop by Egypt. It's been well known there as well. He had so much gold that he completely devastated the economy there. Very interesting that he would devastate an economy of people who were known as Nubians, aka Nubians, who were known to extract Nuba, aka gold, and these people were no longer able to do that. It's quite possible that they were no longer the native people there.
Can you give us some time frame for people in the audience?
Time frame for
For the expedition and possibly for his pilgrimage.
I said agreed.
Yeah, because people might forget this is all relevant because this is before Columbus and this is before Marco Polo and most of those other quote unquote white explorers discovered the world.
I don't know the exact date. I know it was in the 1300s.
Yeah, but it's showing that ancient African civilizations were fully aware of all the trade goods in all these new regions. That's why they're launching these massive expeditions because they know they can get a return on profit.
Medieval African civilizations.
Okay, and the ones before them were doing the same thing, so there's no difference. That's a semantic point you just made.
I just want to be clear. That's what we're talking about, medieval. So his Hajj was in 1324. Mm-hmm.
Hold on. What do you mean by medieval Africa? That's 1600s, right?
He affected the value of gold in the entire region. So it's basically hyperinflation. You know what I mean? It's like, why gold mine when Mansa Musa just dropped, I don't know, 12 carats on you? You know what I mean? He made it rain. And so in that sense, he destabilized the economy by just devaluing gold. You know, it didn't mean anything anymore.
Yeah, he also put a bullseye on Africa for the scramble for Africa centuries later. Keep that in mind as well, because now white people are looking for, quote, cities of gold, Eldorados, et cetera, et cetera. Timbuktus, if you will.
This is a mild criticism of mine. They were trading gold for salt, and I will never, as a person who's very pro-salt, understand its value. I understand that Europeans sailed the seas to find seasonings and still don't use them. But, you know, they had so much gold that they would trade it for salt. We have to understand that Mansa Musa was wealthy beyond any sort of human being we could fathom today, right? We're not talking about a billionaire. We're talking about someone who's more wealthy than the Elon Musk of the world today. I don't want to say a trillionaire or whatnot, but he was more wealthy than any human in history.
Absolutely. And according to other historians of that time who went on to meet Mansa Musa during his expedition over into Mecca, that was about 1364 AD. So it had to have been around that time frame. He gives his following description of the king of Mali. He said he was a young man with a brown skin, a pleasant face, and a good figure. His gifts amazed the eye with their beauty and his splendor. Mansa Musa was known to be a very upkept man, as he should be, being the richest. And after his death, Mansa Musa, about 1387 AD, so he died around that time, the Mali Empire went into a decline. It was followed by short reigns and dynastic rivalries.
Okay, he should have never took, you know, gold to the Europeans and shown that off. Because like, right, you knew what would happen after that. You know, they definitely need to go and start searching for more gold. Because like when they hit, because like when they went to Mali, they're like, damn, where did these people get, you know, like, you know, they're all just walking around, you know, with, you know, gold canes, and like they have gold, you know, pot, you know, amount.
Yeah, Mali, so
they had gold everything.
Like, yeah, yeah. So the words Mali, Mande, and Mandin and Manding are all referring to the same concept of Mali as we know it today, but Mali is from the Fula word. Mali is a Fula word, right? Some people believe that Mali is a reference to a city or some type of town, but there's also a hypothesis that Mali is derived from the word for hippopotamus in the Mande language. And so the Kidas had an odd peculiarity, right, for the hippopotamus, right? A special connection to it, symbolically.
Yeah, and to take away what he did, again, this was a very rich man, 60,000 people. You would have to imagine that some of those people, they went with him and made the expedition to Mecca, and I'm pretty sure not all 60,000 came back. So these were people who were traveling amongst the African continent and were very much able to do so, despite very few, you know, people trying to detract and say that as if there's some type of either genetic barrier or that Black people were simply just not traveling in some sort or fashion. There we have it there. But again, that was a big mistake, I would say, that Mansa Musa was making. Showing off this goal, showing off his extravagant lifestyle, what he could afford, it pretty much led his hand to what the Arabs and these Turkish and Europeans would see as wealth, and which led to, I would say as well, a big colonization of Africa.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. In the same story, I don't know. We haven't talked about the Library of Alexandria, right? But Timbuktu is like West Africa's Alexandria, right? A lot of those books, and Lucifer is going to love this, right, were burned by people from the north as they were retreating from an army. So the same story of Alexandria, where like all this wealth of knowledge is destroyed by some invading army, holds true for Timbuktu. I really don't know why this always happens to great places of learning in Africa. But it is it rhymes, I suppose.
Yeah, 1387. That is the beginning of the overthrow of the Blackmoor ruling era across Southern Europe and England. So all these numbers, the math is mathing, my dudes. White people see the money and they come right for the Black people's throats and they cut them. So I don't understand how our scholars are overlooking all these quote correlations in racial aggression. So
onto this. To make that a connection, what he was talking about, again, 1387 was the death of Mansa Musa. Go ahead, Lou.
Yes, and starting 1350s, that's when the Protestants, or what do they call themselves, Huguenots and all these other weird European groups started splitting off from the Black Holy Roman Catholic Church, because it was run by Black people back then, into the Protestant and Lutherans and other religious groups, to then wage the race war under the guise of, quote, difference of religion, not difference of race. It was racial, but they claimed it was a religious war. Real History Worldwide covers all of that in depth. So he says by 1600s, that's the end of all the Black Catholics in Europe. So there's no more ruling Blacks in Europe. I was like, damn. He's like, okay, so back to Timbuktu. And the Library of Alexandria specifically was called the Library of Rakotis. And the contributors to that library included the Black Persians, the Black Greeks, the Black Spartans, and the Black Carthaginians. All of them had access to that library. And I also suspect Black Asians from China had access to that library, because Julius Caesar's child with, what's his name, Cleo VII? Yeah, the Caesarian. He was sent to China. That means Rome, who had just seized that territory, was fully aware of the Chinese. There's no confusion about that at all. They're like, hey, send him over there. He's going to live out fine with them. They're allies. Okay. All the ships in the Mediterranean were seizing books. We get the word book from a pile of papyrus that was seized to be copied and placed into the Library of Rakotis, aka Library of Alexandria. Alexander the Great came through that area under false pretenses, was welcomed as an ally and a god to fulfill some sort of prophecy, and he stole their kingdom. He's a flat out sucker punched them, took all their black shit, and destroyed the library and rebuilt it on the same spot and filled it back up with his bullshit and called it Alexandria after himself because he's a fucking sociopathic narcissist warlord. He's not some great conqueror. They're liars, they're cheats, they're crazy. He's also biracial. So that's not our black L on that one. We weren't involved in that. Okay. So he destroys the Library of Rakotis, renames it Alexandria, and in that library is the art of war. In that library is the Spartan Greek deceptions. In that library is everything copied from Timbuktu. In that library is whatever is copied from the black Arabs nearby. So there's so many lynch points, and they've proven this, by the way, studying the foundation of the Library of Alexandria. They knew it was 500 years older than the masonry that Alexander put up. So he destroyed the structure that was there standing at least 500 years before his arrival. Sun Tzu was alive 500 years before his arrival. So everything just ties together flawlessly. All these black people were trading knowledge and information peacefully between different factions of black people across multiple continents, Europe, Asia, and Africa at the same damn spot. And one biracial comes in and fucks up everybody's history. Literally. It's like, it's unreal. And then they repeat again in Timbuktu. They're doing it in Oman and Yemen right now. Hold on.
There were plenty of attempts to preserve what was left. Some of the libraries in Timbuktu weren't completely ashen after event, like really recent events, actually. But all of them have like fallen apart. UNESCO had one. There was a Timbuktu manuscripts project. There were plenty of projects. They've all gone underfunded.
Yes, but hold on. Here's the racial context of what you just mentioned. I saw the documentary on those manuscripts and how they're preserved. It was individual black scholars stashing them in secret compartments in their homes for decades. That's the only reason those Afrocentric manuscripts survived to this time period. That's it. The Arabs and white Muslims with their white supremacy indoctrination came into a black region and literally said, kill all the people who have oral history and burn all their books. Reset these Negroes to the fucking Stone Age. That's what happened in West Africa when Muslims came in. That's what they're still doing everywhere else they're right now. They're doing it in Afghanistan, they're doing it in Iraq, they're doing it in Iran, they're doing it everywhere. Persians, they know Persians are black people.
So there's something to be said about Salafis and jihadists and the group who did this, right? But Islam entered Africa, and especially West Africa, through trade. It wasn't like some jihads or something that brought Islam to Mali, Songhai, or Ghana. So we just need to be clear on that, and we need to not characterize an entire religion as being anti-black or terroristic, right?
Okay, well, I'm going to have to keep banging this point. Those acts of trade, they were invited in on trade terms. First came the merchants, then came the missionaries, and then last comes the military. The Arabs are following the white supremacist playbook that Anglo-Saxons used in the New World and Africa and Asia. Do you understand that? So yeah, the 600 AD.
The Arabs were not able to conquer these places, though. I mean, that's not
exactly.
These empires all fell apart because of conflict with people like the Moors and whatnot. But they are one another, rather. But the idea that there was like an Arab conquest of like Northwest or the Sahel or what they call Bilad al-Sudan.
I would say Arabs own about 30% of Africa right now, black and white parts of Africa. Everyone speaks Arabic. Everyone worships their dicks, and everyone sends their money from Africa to white Arabia right now. So 30% of Africa is Arab controlled, white Arab controlled right now. Do you disagree with that?
There are plenty of people who identify as Arab in North Africa.
Okay, so they have these people mentally colonized, and it was a racial war when they got there because I described how they laid out the blankets for trade, allowed the local black tribes people to come to the blanket, especially the women. They brought black women to the trade blanket and then leapt out from behind dunes, seized them by force, put them in chains, and took their asses all the way back to Black Arabia, where they castrated the men and boys. We forgot about that part, didn't we? How they made them into eunuchs for centuries of, quote, trading. Yeah, they're slave trading. They didn't come here to spread no religion, bro. They came here, the religion is the cover. That's the deception. Oh, we're here to be allies and brothers, brotherhood, Islam, Allah Malika. Yeah. Now that you let your guard down, like our other white bloodline, we're gonna cut your fucking throats. Pardon the language.
Yeah, and we can definitely get into the Arab expansion at another date. I'm pretty sure that'll be an interesting topic as well. We are coming to the tail end of the Mali Empire. Timbuktu, for example, was captured by the Tuareg nomads in about 1433. And a domino effect led to Mali being no more. This is when we see the uprising then of the Songhai Empire. It was a capital of Songhai Gao, strategically positioned along the Niger River. They used the river to extend their empire, stretching from modern-day Niger to Nigeria. So again, when we're talking about these waterway civilizations, this would be one of them as well, that used that water source as a benevolent way of trade along the Niger River. So yeah, the Songhai Empire, we start off with the first great leader. In 1464 till about 1492, we have Sunni Ali the Great. And according to the Gao oral history, he was a hero and a man of great physical presence. And he would often use sorcery. He was quite known for that. And they have plenty of oral traditions when it comes to Ali the Great and his accomplishments. After Ali the Great, we then had the Muhammad Ture. He ruled around 1492 till about 1528. He was a successor. He continued to flourish the Songhai presence. It will be a combination of about drought and invasions and civil war. And there was like a jealousy apparently as well within the ranks, within the family, specifically with his son, that led to about a 1591 collapse. And at that point, the Songhai Empire had broken off into different kingdoms. And they broke off to different kingdoms because of the that decline, but they were also able to continue a cultural civilization, albeit smaller, because they made these connections through these, again, these waterway civilizations.
Other than you can have access to every part of Africa from Atlantis to Kemet to Nigeria to even going out into the Atlantic Ocean over to Colombia and the New World, it's pretty comprehensive. Like, that's a lot of interactions we got to cover.
Find full episodes of the podcast featuring Straight Facts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube. Also, check out our Instagram for more Maroc Oris content, including the shop and our subscription service for exclusives. Peace, Mer. I'm on Maroc.